invite you to turn in your Bibles to Ecclesiastes chapter 1. We're going to read through the first 11 verses. You can find that on page 662 in your pew Bibles. This actually begins a new series in the book of Ecclesiastes for us. I had a couple of weeks where I wasn't preaching, you may have noticed, during Advent. Once again, thank you to our two Bills and also to Martin. And during that time, I spent a lot of time praying and planning out the sermon schedule for the year to come. And one book that continued to come back to me was the book of Ecclesiastes. I'm not precisely sure why, but I feel compelled to begin this year by leading us through about, I think it's a 6 or 7 part series on Ecclesiastes. Many people steer away from this book, and for good reason. I don't know, when was the last, how many of you have read Ecclesiastes within the last year? A couple of you, okay. See, not that many. That was maybe 0.5% of the body here. How about in the last 5 years, maybe? Yeah, a couple more. Most people, when they read Ecclesiastes, become confused, and there's good reason for that. It is a wisdom book in the Old Testament. It's categorized along with Proverbs and Song of Songs as wisdom literature, but this type of wisdom literature can be confusing, to put it lightly. One of the reasons Ecclesiastes is confusing is because there appear to be an awful lot of contradictions in the book. The teacher, whose name is Kohelet, which is the name in Hebrew, Kohelet, the teacher. Ecclesiastes comes from the Greek meaning an assembly or convener of the assembly. You can hear ecclesia in there for the people of God, as it were. But Kohelet works with contradiction. And on the one hand, he'll say, life is meaningless. And then on the other hand, he'll say, life is full of meaning. He'll say, work is drudgery. And then on the other hand, he'll say, all the joy that you can find in life is in your work. And on the one hand, he'll say, or give the indication that once you die, there's nothing more after that. But then in another passage, he'll suggest that there's going to be some form of judgment after death. And you kind of go, holy smokes, what's going on in this book? All of these contradictions. I've called this series, or I've subtitled, it's The Wisdom of Ecclesiastes, and the subtitle is Paradoxes That Heal. A paradox is what happens when you have two appearingly contradictory things that when looked at under another light are actually reconcilable. It's a paradox. They don't seem that both of these two things could be true. Life is meaningless. Life has meaning. But then when you look at it another way, you see that it is true. Both of those things are true. And I think one of the ways that the author of Ecclesiastes is going to communicate the truth of God is by means of paradox. And his intention is to undeceive us. Because we have ways of looking at the world which do not comport with the truth of the world, but he's going to invite us into looking at the world that way so that he can pull back the covers and show us a new way. Ecclesiastes 1:1 through 11, the opening. And if this sounds familiar to a few of you, I preached a version of this sermon about 6 years ago in this place. It was summertime, there was 30 people or so. I thought about rewriting it, and then I looked at it, and I thought, no, I'm not going to do that. This is great. So, Ecclesiastes 1:1 through 11. The words of the teacher, or Kohelet, son of David, king in Jerusalem. Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher, utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. What is man, or what does a human being gain from all his labor at which he toils under the sun? Generations come and generations go, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun sets and hurries back to where it rises. The wind blows to the south and turns to the north. Round and round it goes, ever returning on its course. All streams flow into the sea, yet the sea is never full. To the place the streams come from, there they return again. All things are wearisome, more than one can say. The eye never has enough of seeing, nor the ear its fill of hearing. What has been will be again. What's been done will be done again. There's nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which one can say, look, this is something new? No, it was here already long ago. It was here before our time. There is no remembrance of men of old, and even those who are yet to come will not be remembered by those who follow. The word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Chaval chavalim amar kohelet. Chaval chavalim chaka chaval. Sound funny? That is verse 2, the opening words of Kohelet when read in the Hebrew. It's onomatopoeia. It sounds like what it is. Absurd. Meaningless. And that's Kohelet's primary charge against this world. This world is absurd. Chaval chavalim amar kohelet. Chaval chavalim chakal chaval. Meaningless, or vanity of vanities, or probably best, a breath, and nothing but a fleeting breath. Everything is but a breath. From one perspective, life can indeed appear to be totally meaningless, totally absurd. And it can, says Kohelet, because from one angle, from one particular way of looking at the world, it's true. It's absolutely, incontrovertibly true. Life is absurd. And it's not too hard to see it. All you have to do is open your eyes and look around at the world. And the place to begin, Kohelet suggests in verse 3, is at your own life. Just look down for a moment at your own toiling work. For starters, right? You wake and you sleep. You wake and you sleep. You wake and you sleep over and over again. And then you go to work and come home. And go to work and come home. And go to work and come home over and over again. The framer frames up one house and then another over and over again. The plumber plumbs up one pipe and then another over and over again. The teacher teaches one class and then another over and over again. The nurse helps one patient and then another one over and over again. And the mother, let's not forget the mother. The mother does one thing in 1 second and then a nanosecond later, she does the same thing because another diaper needs to be done. Or the crumbs have arrived on the floor again. She doesn't have a moment before she's doing the same thing all over again. And here's the thing, right? Nothing, for the most part, changes with any of it. From one perspective, it's basically all the same monotony, mundane, the iteration of things. It's a great big circle of doing that goes around and around and around without ever really arriving anywhere. And this can begin to strike us as not just a little bit odd, right? This certain nauseating repetitiveness to life. This certain nauseating repetitiveness. Kind of like a Roy Orbison record that gets stuck. Pretty woman, a walking down the street, a pretty woman, a pretty woman, a pretty woman. Records are coming back. Believe me, it's going to start happening again. And we're like, stop it, Roy, enough already. And the toiling work of our hands, says Kohelet, can feel that way too. Just stuck, bland, blasé, never fundamentally going anywhere, except as it seems to us, in vicious and vicious circles. And so the question that's got to strike us like a thunderbolt, says Kohelet, is, okay, fine, but what's the point? What is the point of all of our waking and sleeping and toilsome work when, for the most part, it doesn't really get us anywhere different or achieve any substantial progress? As Kohelet will say and argue throughout this whole book, we do all of this work and work so hard to get ahead and achieve something. But for what? Yes, we may put up a few houses. Yes, we may raise up a couple of kids. Yes, we may be able to earn a little money for ourselves and circumscribe our houses with nice little white picket fences. But for what? What is ultimately gained for you, Donald Trump, by all of your surplus? What is ultimately advantaged to you, you successful workaholic, for all of your work? Is anything we capitalists do capitalizing anything of ultimate value or worth for us? Well, humiliatingly, no. Not at all. For as we know, and as Colette will beat on like a drum major throughout the entirety of this book, beyond the circularity of our work, which is bad enough, the mocking reality for us human beings is that after we've swallowed a few short breaths comprised of, oh, I don't know, maybe a few love songs, a few victories, a few defeats, a few wipes of our drippy eyes and nose, then death will come upon us like a bandit and snatch us away like a thief, and that will be it. And all the work we will have done, how much will it amount to? Zilch. Nada. Zero. Nothing. And so what will all of our restless striving and sweating have proved? That we were smart? That we were wise? That we spent our time well? No, oh no. Instead, says Colette somberly, the only thing in light of our impending deaths that all of our sweat-filled, reaching and aspiring work will have proved is that we were like madmen when we lived. We were like people who went out to Crescent Beach, and when the wind came up, we started running around the beach trying to catch the wind with our fishnets instead of pulling out our kites. It's absurd. It's nothing but a pointless rat race. Chapter 2, 17, 18, so I hated life because the work that is done under the sun was grievous to me. All of it is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. I hated all the things I toiled for under the sun, because, in light of death, I must leave them to the one who comes after me. What's the point? Chapter 3, 19, man's fate is like that of the animals. The same fate awaits them both. As one dies, so dies the other. All have the same breath. Man has no advantage, even over the animal. Everything is meaningless. Beloved, it's true. Colette is right. Accept it from one angle, from one particular point of view, life really can begin to appear unequivocally and utterly absurd, pointless. And it makes it really hard to be thankful and joyful for the lives that we have. And we probably know people who are that way, grumpy, cantankerous about the fact of life. Some of us are that way. Even now, we feel maybe like we're stuck in the Perpetual Groundhog's Day. Remember that movie with Bill Murray? And he has to do the same wretched day over and over again. And the same song awakes him every single morning. I forget what it was, but he's stuck. And the truth is, as Colette expresses in verses 5 through 9, when we have begun to experience our own lives as absurd in this way, when this worldview has captivated our hearts, things then will only get worse. Because we will then begin to see the same absurdity played out in our life, played out in the whole world. The lenses behind our eyes will change, and we will see, look at it. It's not only us, we who make a lot of noise and do a lot of work that doesn't get us anywhere. Astonishingly, even the most fundamental elements in the very universe itself, these things which were here before we got here and will be here long after we're gone, even these things are apparently stuck on this absurd, repetitive wheel that doesn't change a thing, gain a thing, or move anywhere substantial. Verse 5, generations come and generations go, and that's us. He's talking about generations of people. But the earth, and here the earth too, remains the same forever. It's the same. Just like us, it doesn't change. And consider that. Even though, unlike us, the earth doesn't fade away in death, it, despite all its grueling work, like us, remains stubbornly the same. Never getting anywhere substantial, arriving at no progress worth mentioning. As we can see as plain as day with our naked eyes as we look from high to low and back again. Up high, in the middle, down low. Just try it. Just look, says Colette. The absurdity of life is everywhere. Look up, says Colette. You see? The sun rises, the sun sets, and then it hurries back to the place where it rises. It's just a circle. It's a large circle. Going on like this ad infinitum over and over again. History is going nowhere. And look in the middle, Colette. You see? The wind. Take the wind. The wind blows to the south and turns to the north. Round and round it goes, ever returning on its course. It's a circle. And look down at the ground. Even there, it's the same ruddy thing when you look at it long enough. All streams flow into the sea, yet the sea is never full. To the place the streams come from, there they return again. Another circle, over and over again. The sun, the wind, the sea change nothing up there in the middle, down low, gain nothing. They're all just stuck like we are on this dizzying, repetitive, whirly-magig of a world where we're all stuck like hamsters on a treadmill. And it's absurd. And beloved, may I tell you what you already know? The problem with an absurd world like this is that, as some of us know all too well, and as Colette discovered the hard way, a world like this is a remarkably depressing world. It's fatiguing. Just like the whole first half of this sermon, it's hard to be thankful for. As Colette says in verse 8, it is just wearisome. All things are wearisome, more than one can say. And it's wearisome for some rather obvious reasons. I think we all feel and experience regularly, right? Because in an absurd world like this, you know, where is the wonder? All wonder can be sucked away. Where is the meaning? Where is the surprise? Where is the deep, abiding joy and satisfaction that we long for, that our hearts yearn for? Oh, where? Because the truth is, a world like this that just circles and circles in time without giving us what we ask of it becomes to us a machine, a closed system where nothing is ever new. It's an agglutinative assemblage of materials and movements, a mechanical, robotic absurdity that, despite all of its apparent beauty, is utterly predictable, totally expected, governed by impersonal laws, and in addition to all of this, it is incredibly stingy to us human beings. We who are here consider it for such a pathetic wisp of time and then gone like that, like, you know, water on hot pavement in the summertime, just vaporized. And so all in all implies, Colette, such a world viewed in such a way is, as we might put it, an insurmountable bore. That's right, it's a bore, where we become insatiable, cynical, sticks in the mud. As he conveys in the remaining verses of our text, in this world, trapped into this perspective of things, listen to him complain. The eye never has enough of seeing. That sounds like a modern ring, doesn't it? The ear never has enough of hearing. What has been will be again. What's been done will be done again. There's nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which anyone could say, look, this is something new? His conclusion here? No. It was already here long ago. It was here before our time. There's no remembrance of men of old, and even those that come won't be remembered by those that follow. Life is a bore, a meaningless slugfest. So why get up in the morning? Why come to church today and give thanks for this drudgery? Any of you there feeling stuck? Bored? Well, I've got good news for you this morning. There is a way to get unstuck. There is a way, in fact, to become like Alice in Wonderland, Dorothy in Oz, and googly-eyed Lucy in Narnia. Believe it, there is a way for you to begin seeing this world and all of your so-called monotonous work, its circular circles, and all the rest of it as well, as nothing short as the most wild and wonderful events, the most joy-intoxicating, meaningful occurrences that can possibly be imagined. It's true. You know how? It's very simple, even though it is the hardest thing you will ever do. And it will take time, but let me tell you, here it is. Stoop. Stoop down low. Be willing to become little. Incredibly little. Or to put it the other way around, stop trying to be so darn big. You see, friends, the whole problem with the perspective we've been looking at, and which Colette himself is, please believe, critiquing and trying to subvert, which views this world from the perspective of what we human beings might gain out of it, of what our work might capitalistically achieve for us, and which therefore leaves us frustrated beyond belief because it won't ultimately give up its goods. The problem with this view of the world is that it is a poisonous byproduct of trying to be far too big, taking ourselves too seriously. As Colette subtly tries to get us to see, by indeed having us compare ourselves to the elemental wonders in the heaven up high and the sky in the middle and the earth below. Consider it. Even the sun That unimaginably fantastic fireball in the sky, which, as the psalmist says in Psalm 19, is like, quote, a glorious bridegroom coming forth from its pavilion, like a champion rejoicing to run its course. Even the sun doesn't change anything or gain anything by its circular journey from east to west and back again. But it doesn't need to be rejoiceful. And neither does the wondrous wind. And neither do the sensational rivers and streams. And so we are to ask ourselves why. Why in heaven's name, or to put it as Colette does in this book, why as mere creatures under the sun, under heaven, should we think we should? We who are so little, why do we seek such gain? We who are respectively so small in the grand scheme of things, why do we strive for the moon and become depressed when we don't reach it? Answer, because we're trying to be too blooming big for our own good. Our problem is that we're not content to simply marvel at the moon. We want to possess it. Our problem is that we're not content to simply ask, what does the world want from me? Because in our pride and hubris, we're too busy asking, what do I want from the world? Or to put it another way, in short and in sum, our Herculean problem, friends, is that we have not been content to be exactly and precisely what we are. Little creatures. We little hobbit-like creatures. Fragile under a very big God who has created such a big and miraculous world that it is at least arguable that if we were little enough, we would see that there is enough wonder packed into a single solitary black ant that is audaciously carrying a piece of bread or something else that's 30 times its weight on its shoulder. It is at least arguable that if we were little enough, that single black ant, if it were the only thing left on earth, would keep us surprised and enthralled for a lifetime. If we were little enough. You know, little like St. Francis of Assisi, skipping and dancing for the moon, preaching to the red-winged warblers, or little like children, young children, like my children when they were young. It never ceased to amaze me at just how filled with wonder my kids could be at the most ordinary and mundane things when they were growing up. Driving along in the van, and one of the kids, he's like, Daddy, a plane! And then a couple seconds, like, another one, wow! Or I was standing in the shower one time, enjoying a very nice hot shower. One of my kids breaks in through the door like a thunderstorm. Daddy, Daddy, come quickly, and runs out of the shower. So I run out, wet and naked, to where they were. They're in the other bathroom, quiet, mesmerized over top of a bathtub, looking at a tiny little specked black thing in the bathtub. Look, Daddy, a spider. We're going to the park, right? It's amazing that adults invented parks. They have a thing called a merry-go-round. Do you know what a merry-go-round does? It goes in a circle over and over again. And there are children on. They're having a blast. Around and around. It bores us to tears. We don't do that anymore as adults, not least of all because we'd probably get sick. But we were there once, weren't we? The repetition wasn't a problem for us. How in heaven's name has an inchworm dropping in upon us from the tree above become humdrum? How has biting into a juicy Fuji apple that squirts out when we chomp on it become anything less than a prodigy? How is it that when we wake up in the morning after a deep and deleterious sleep for several hours, a mini death, we don't wake up with a start as though a miracle just happened? It's morning! Holy smokes! Where'd that come from? And we don't look down at our legs and marvel at the digits at the bottom of our feet. How has this happened? Have we become too big for our own good, reaching and striving for too much and thereby missing the much that is here, the prodigious gift of life? Maybe, right? Maybe we have. And so maybe it's time for us to stoop again, to become little, embracing the fact that we are simply creatures, dependent and weak, that we are born in weakness and that we will die in weakness. Poverty is our middle name. I suggest to you that this is the way to big, folks. Small is the way to large. Tiny is the way to titanic. After all, as we know, this is exactly how it works. Alice crawls into a little hole and enters into a massive world of wonder. Dorothy goes to sleep in a storm and wakes up in the Land of Oz. Lucy climbs into an unsuspecting wardrobe in an insignificant empty little room and finds herself in a universe that is nothing short of magical. And the reality is that the wardrobe stands open before us this morning, as Colette is saying and urging in his own wisdom way by means of paradox. We who will, by the grace of God, enter in through the narrow gate of humility and be content to skip along the narrow road of creatureliness, we will be projected into a world of enjoyment where we will be able to receive our lives and all of the circles within them for exactly what they are. In truth, they are wild and wonderful gifts of God. They are far out and phenomenal presents that are given back to us every single day, not because we are deserving, not because we are entitled, not because this world is a predictable machine that has been impersonally determined, but because and only because at the center of the universe there is a heartbeat of a personal creator who stands above the circle of the earth and who is pleased. He's pleased to stand up every morning again and to his creation to say, "Do it again! Do it again, Earth, keep spinning. Do it again, stars. Do it again, sun, rotate again. Yes, do it again, wonderful job. Do it again, moon. Do it again, birds. Do it again, bees. And to our bodies, do it again, heart. Do it again, lungs, pump and keep pumping and pump." Yes, my sisters and brothers, to be little, to be small, to find ourselves for what we are in truth. We're mere creatures, and yet we're underneath a glorious creator, where everything is gift, daily renewed, where everything, if we have eyes to see, is surprise. Even black ants and inchworms and the marvelously glowing moon. Jesus is dead right. "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. And blessed are those who are big enough to be little, to be pure in heart, for they shall see God, and they shall see him everywhere, up high, down in the middle, down low. In the sun, in the wind, and the sea, everywhere, the mighty gift giver." So, beloved, please be little. Be humble as creatures under your creator, for the world you will enter will be big. A rich oil tycoon dies and he goes to heaven, and to his incredible surprise for the life he lived, he finds himself before the pearly gates, and there's St. Peter. St. Peter says, "Come in. You may enter in." And the oil tycoon looked at the door. The door was 1 mile wide, but 3 feet high. And he turned back to St. Peter and he said, "I'm 6 feet tall, maybe 7 feet. You expect me to duck down and get under that door? You got to be kidding me. I never stooped down for anything in my life." And so he stood there for all eternity before an open door. Brothers and sisters, we must become little to be big. We've got to get up on downward mobility before God. And just one more thing. Before those of you who are truly depressed accuse me of being incredibly insensitive, and before those of you who are so stuck properly in the pain and suffering that our sick and cruel world can indeed deliver accuse me of being an idealistic doofus, let me just say this. You cannot do this on your own, no matter how much you try. I recognize that none of us can. We can no more make ourselves little than a tall man can make himself short. Because as far as I know and have experienced, there is only one wardrobe and one act of grace that can bring us to the big side of little. Jesus Christ and a vision of him which simultaneously crucifies our pride as well as our pain. And so in conclusion, let me just say, if you long to become little and enter into a big world, then do this and keep on doing it. Look to the one who became little for you to save you and obsess on him. Look to Jesus Christ, who though God, as God, was so big, became so little, becoming human, taking on the form of a slave in order to make all things new. Look to the one who, though majesty and purity himself, was willing to become little enough to hang out with hookers and whores and hoodlums, and in his littleness to imagine big things for them, turning hookers into holiness and whores into brides and hoodlums into the chairman of international charity clubs. Yes, and finally, look to the one who, though life itself, died so that we might live, and who at last, although he was in his humanity so big in showing his emotions clearly and powerfully, he was willing, it seems, as G.K. Chesterton once mused, to somewhat conceal one certain emotion in littleness, because perhaps for us to see it in all of its force and fullness would have been too much, too staggering, too striking. Here's how Chesterton puts it. The Stoics, ancient and modern, were proud of concealing their tears, but Jesus never concealed his tears. He showed them plain on his face at any daily sight. Yet Jesus concealed something. Solemn supermen and imperial diplomatists are proud of restraining their anger. Jesus never restrained his anger. He flung furniture down the front steps of the temple and asked men how they expected to escape the damnation of hell. Yet Jesus restrained something. I say it with reverence. There was in that shattering personality a thread that must be called shyness. There was something that Jesus hid from all men when he went up on a mountain to pray. There was something that he covered constantly in abrupt silence or impetuous isolation. There was some one thing that was too great for God to show us when he walked upon our earth. And I have sometimes fancied that it was his mirth, the bigness of his joy. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit, amen. I'm not sure if the children are joining us. Do we know? The children may come. We're going to go straight into the communion at this